With that, we're starting the talk, Automate Yourself Out of Supply Chain Hell by Sai.
All right. Thank you. All right, hello. You should probably see my slide. I don't know if I should change. Yeah, there you go. The title is kind of almost the same, but I'm not like, I don't care for the words a lot. So, hi. I think you kind of mixed something up. In my opinion, tomorrow is the last day of camp and not today, but let's wait for the closing ceremony. Okay. Anyway, I would like to talk a little about supply chain with kind of like a focus on software development and third-party libraries and stuff like that, and we get to that. Also about, if one of you is like in security management or stuff like that and you would like to know what your developers are doing, you could also profit. And in the end, I will try to show like a way to automate updates and patches because I'm a lazy developer and you should probably be too, and automate all your stuff that is no fun away so you can do the fun stuff. All right, let's get into it. Also, if you have questions, I'm okay if you just raise your hand and scream at me, because otherwise I will forget the question or where I was at. And yeah. My name is Chris. Some people say Sai. Some people say Christian. I'm a software engineer. I'm from Germany. I'm interested in security and DevOps and automation. I live over there in the Milliways village. So if you want to talk about this later on, come by. We have beer and probably food. And yeah, I'll try to talk a little about finding vulnerabilities during the whole DevOps thing. So if you develop software, if you're like involved in product development or software development, you probably know that, or you probably use like at least a handful of packages that you got from the internet, and those libraries will also be like, yeah, I also got my 10 or 200 friends that want to be on your computer and your servers. And then we want to talk about how to be transparent about this and how we can automate patching. I just added. So thank you. Any questions? No, I'm kidding. I have some questions. Who in you is actually developing software as okay, that's a lot. And who is doing security, or who is responsible for security or security management? Okay. Who knows that they have CVEs in their software that they are running in production? All right, thanks. At least I'm not the only idiot. Okay, all right. And we'll get to that point. Maybe you just, apparently you know, so yeah. One more disclaimer. I'm not actually a security person, so if I do something wrong, please also raise your hand and correct me. I love that. So a lot of you know modern software development. Well, it used to be something like build everything from scratch. And you will find on this campground people who want to build everything from scratch. And there's possibly situations where this is a good idea. Like if you do very sensitive stuff, you should at least review probably every line of crypto that goes in there, or every line of authentication code and stuff like that. But I guess most developers don't have the time to do this, so they just go to ChatGPT, I heard earlier, but also stuff like Stack Overflow or Google, and say, I need a library for authentication, and one for web servers, and one for whatever. And then you just use this, and hopefully it has a lot of stars on GitHub, so you trust it, right? Hopefully not. All right. Obviously, we want to reuse stuff because there's also an upside. That sounded kind of condescending, but there's also an upside. I'm a software developer. I'm not a security person. There's probably at least a handful of people on the planet who can write better security software and better web servers than I can, and that also have time for this, and I don't. So I would like to reuse stuff that is hopefully vulnerability-free. We all know that's not going to happen, so we try to at least check for it. A coworker of mine sent me this picture a couple of years ago, and this is what modern software looks like after a couple of years, in my opinion. So you find some manager comes up, you're like, hey, we want this new feature. Probably you have heard the request this year to add AI to your servers or software. And so you plug it in at some spot where there's still some space. And Yeah, in the end, hopefully there's someone who has still some overview where there's possible plugs and where what you can unplug if it's screwed. All right, a short introduction to vulnerabilities, and someone didn't translate eine short intro, but we'll get there. So there's a kind of an enumeration and a document about any vulnerability that is found and that is publicly known. And I'll jump over this in a minute, or get back in a minute. So there is this CVE, Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures Index. So every vulnerability gets assigned a number with special rules or following special rules, and then there is public databases where you can actually query all these vulnerabilities, so you can read about it. They also have a description that looks like that, and I took the liberty of using Log4j or Log4Shell because that was a really big thing a couple of years ago. If you do Java, you probably at least had to check your software if you're using it twice or 10 times. And hopefully you didn't find the version that was irgendwie was somehow vulnerable. My German Tourette's acted up. Did you notice? All right. And if you find one of these vulnerabilities in your software, or if you read that there's a patch for your software that prevents this kind of vulnerability, you should probably patch it rather sooner than later. Now I get back to this example that I put up. There's a company called Equifax in the US. They call themselves a credit bureau. They have a lot of customers. Their customers are you and me, possibly, if you have ever bought something in the US. And at some point, a vulnerability on Apache Struts, that's a Java web framework, was found and was announced, and they didn't patch it for like 6 weeks or so, and then somebody hacked them because they could exploit vulnerabilities in the software. And someone managed to get a shitload of private information from their customers or consumers, which is really sad because the people didn't even know they're in this database. This would probably be a bigger thing in Europe. In the US, I heard people are not so privacy sensitive about their data. But could have been prevented if they just knew about the vulnerability and ran the patch and done. Hopefully with no more effort. So just a couple more things about the CVEs. So there is a couple of organizations that are allowed to assign these numbers. So if you find a vulnerability, you can go to, for example, Amitre, that is an American institute or institution, and they can give you a number if they deem that your report or that your report about the vulnerability is kind of credible. And then there is this one big database, the National Vulnerability Database at the NIST, where this CVE information gets saved, and then everybody in the world can download it and look at it, so to see the description and to check if they are vulnerable in one way or the other. And over the years, we didn't only have like the one authority that was certified to give out these numbers. When I last checked, we had like almost 500 of those. So you see some of the signs you might know already. So we get to a very high number because everyone and their mother on the internet can basically give out those numbers. And then again, you have like the Linux Foundation, who is also now able to, or is it kernel.org? I'm not sure how they are like related. They are also allowed to hand out these numbers, and they do that for about every bug now in the Linux kernel because it's could be exploited usually. But yeah, that's not like so deep in the talk here. Some weeks ago, the Americans, maybe you heard about it, the US government is trying to save a shitload of money, so they pulled the support for NIST to run the, or for Mitre and NIST to run this database, and they threatened to put to get it off the internet. And the European Union has luckily already been working on their own database, and they like finished it with a lot of effort to say like, hey, look, we just pulled something out of the hat. So now if you pull or query stuff from the NIST, you could also query it from the ENISA. They're working on it to make it really like compatible. And so on and on. And there's a lot of other databases like that also feed their own information outside of the CVE numbering into these indices. Like SNCC is a very known, well-known company that sells security products. They can assign their own numbers, put it in their database, and then if you're a customer, you can query it. If you're not, you have to hope someone else finds the issue. All right. So practical usage. Sorry. If you are a software developer and you run any kind of automation, you can also use that on your own laptop or computer, but it's probably something that you want to automate as everything in your development lifecycle. There's a tool called Dependency Check. I don't care which tool you use. You should use just any of the tools that can do this. This is like an open source OWASP project, so it's kind of credible. It has a lot of support. The maintainer is really quick if you ask them something, so I like it. Yeah, but there's alternatives, so I don't want to do like an advertisement or so. So what this essentially does is the tool goes to this database, queries it for all the records, downloads them, and stores them in a local database, and then checks your program code for the libraries that you are using and the libraries that your libraries are using, you know, like the whole family of libraries and their mother and their brother, and then checks them if it can find the version in this database. Let's say you find a log4j version 2.13-ish that had this log4shell vulnerability, then the scanner will go like, oops, I found something, please do something about it. And basically, if you automate this and put it in your CI pipelines, you will just have like a lot of added security for free, because while you develop, you will always see that your stuff doesn't build depending on how you set up the tool. All right. This is how it looks. If you start it for the first time, you will take a long time to download all the records, and then it's stored, and every time you run it, it will just add some diffs. Hint, while you do this, you can get an API key from the NIST. It's for free, and you should totally do this. And if you start it and it's slow, you can get a key, make coffee, grab coffee, come back, insert the key, start over, and you'll still be quicker. All right, I will show you a quick Java app that I made some time ago, a couple weeks ago. And I just need to find the correct window. So this is like a, you don't have to do Java or Maven. It works on most other languages too. So just to make sure this is not like needed to understand this. So this is like a POM file for Maven. So there is, oh, my bad. Like that. Okay. So, sorry. This is a POM file for Maven. This is like where you like list all the dependencies that your program should download from the internet when you build it. And I can probably also do that bigger. And then I just to make sure that the scanner finds something, I added this vulnerable version of log4shell or log4j, so we can actually demonstrate this. And what you can do with the scanner now is like run a, I installed the plugin, or I put the plugin for dependency check into it. Well, I think I have it in history. So you say, hey, dependency check, please go check this repo. So, and then you see there is like a lot of different scanners running, and at some point gives you a very simplistic output where it says like, hey, look, I found a vulnerability or more of those. And then there's a couple more info in it. I will show it in a second in a better viewable thing. But now you can use the return of this CLI expression and like, for example, break your CI pipeline, because you say, okay, there was any kind of vulnerability found, so I have to care for it before I can merge this in production. So I want to show you the report that comes out of it. So this adds like a HTML report. Obviously, you don't need this in CI. It's okay in CI if it just breaks. But this is something where you can learn a lot about the vulnerability and how it works and stuff. So you have like the vulnerability itself, so you see which package it came from. And then you have a list of what's actually happening. So this one now has a lot of vulnerabilities. You get like a lot of numbers, like confidence and criticality. There should be some critical. Oh yeah. So they say severity and a number. So if it says critical in any case, you should probably look at what you're doing. You know, like. There's a lot of false positives in this, sadly. So I would guess like 95% of the criticals that you find in your software, you can ignore because you are not using the vulnerable code at this time. Like let's say you use a JSON parser that can also parse XML and the XML implementation has a problem, but you don't use any kind of XML, you could probably be safe, but maybe it's in the engine, so you should definitely take a look at it. Then you have like a lot of stuff, so you have the explanation, what is happening, like blah, something, Apache Log4j had a configuration that where you could inject code into log messages, and this is the vulnerability. It doesn't matter what it is for now. And then you have a lot of references, and this was like really big. And I think a lot of you like nodded when I said log for shell. So you have a lot of advisories, so you can actually read through all of these. And if you don't know anything about security, but you're a software developer, you should probably understand most of it, and then you've learned something and can educate people on it. All right. So now back to the presentation, and I need to search my mouse. Okay. So this is like what a very condensed CI pipeline or automation should look like, in my opinion. You have like you push code, it should get built, it should be tested. Please do tests. Then it should be deployed somewhere, and maybe you want to run more tests, but at least deploy it once to see if it starts. And then you do a release. You don't have to do this strictly, but you want some versioning, probably. And then you can do whatever you want, like ship it to production, forget about it. And now what you can do is, for example, add dependency check in parallel to the testing. It runs really quick, takes a couple seconds. You do it in parallel, so you don't lose any time. If you can parallelize, like let's say most people probably do cloud workloads, so it's rather easy. Most computers can also handle a couple more parallel tests. And what you should probably do, in my opinion, is to stop the pipeline and go do some kind of alert. You can also set up dependency check to only break, like if it finds something with a high or critical severity. But there might be combinations of medium and low ones. So I'm a fan to go over all the vulnerabilities in the project once, see if you can update stuff to avoid some, and see if you if it's okay to like allow list others. You do some notifications, and then you have direct feedback. While developing the feature, you can go ahead and fix it. All right. If you don't use Java, I said before, there's like a lot of frameworks that are covered by dependency check. But as I said, there's also a lot of other tools that can do the same. If you do Docker, your best bet is probably Trivy or Clare. Just to leave some numbers here, it's both open source tools, more or less maintained, more or less heavy on false positives. But like different story. So I just want to like put that all together. The upside for me is you get an alert as early as possible during development, so you don't have to like add a new vulnerability in a new library that you need for some weird feature. Then ship it. Then you have like a security team that comes back to you, and then you fix something, and then you have miscommunication and stuff because they don't know what you're doing, and vice versa. So personally, I think it's the best if you get the feedback as soon as possible. You can stop the automation or not, depending on how you configure it. I personally love to have a zero vulnerability policy. So every vulnerability has to be accounted for, either updated the library or made like a statement in some kind of log file or allow list or something. The downside is, if you use it, it doesn't get worse, but there is still low transparency. So if something like Log4Shell pops up, there will be some central security teams, especially if you're in a bigger organization, that also want to know which team is running this version of Log4j, for example. And this tooling is kind of not good for tracking this, because then they would have to look at everyone's reports for every version and every merge request and everything. And that is kind of like it's from a time frame perspective, it's not possible, in my opinion. There's also no tracking. You can pick up on trends, like we all love gamification. So at some point, if you want to say, I have like 1,000 vulnerabilities because I just started running dependency check, but the software is already old, you will see a lot of vulnerabilities. And at some point, you want to say, let's say, ignore or look at 100 a week. Most of them just take like 2 minutes or so. So you might want to track if it gets better, because you can't just do everything now, maybe. And it has to, the check has to be run consistently. So if you develop a feature and then the software is lying around for 3 months, you don't get any feedback because the CI pipelines won't run, maybe. And it also needs access to code, but basically everything does. All right, so we need more transparency. This is where the software bill of materials comes into play. You probably will have to build a software bill of materials in the next couple of years. I will get to that. Just like a spoiler, the Cyber Resilience Act is coming up, and you will have to provide, or at least you will have to have a software bill of materials for your stuff. And I get to what it is in a second. So the problem is, typically, security doesn't know who's using which version of which library. And there's also, I tried to shade out some projects, because there's also development teams who don't know which version they're using. Because either they use latest, or they use pinned versions, or they have inherited the software, and they are running it, and they are like, from a policy point, they are, what's it called? They are the ones who have to take care of it, but they don't have the time or whatever. And there might be big projects, and then you also might have external libraries from other companies that you buy because you're a customer, or that you get for free on the internet. And you also, especially if you buy libraries and clients and complete software packages, usually you don't really know what's inside. Without a lot of effort. So typically, at least if something happens, security team will come like, hey, who is using Log4j? And then you have to start handling Excel sheets and wiki pages. And then the next manager wants to know how the security team is doing, or they go direct and so on. You all know this if you've worked in a company consisting of, let's say, more than one people. We can do like an inventory. Software bill of materials is a nested inventory for software, a list of ingredients, I would say. And since I'm from Germany, I provided a software bill of materials for one of my favorite foods, which is Schnitzel Pommes Salat. So it's Schnitzel and fries and salad. You could imagine, like, if you want to, you go to a restaurant and you want to know which ingredients are in the food. So you go like, hey, can I have an S-bomb? And then you have like the what you could call libraries or the dependencies that the schnitzel is made of. So you have, let's go vegan, you have seitan and some kind of covering. I don't know the English term. Then you have potatoes, and then you have some salad. In the salad, you have also onions and sauce. And then you have go one level further, because all these ingredients have their own ingredients, if they're not like fresh and growing on trees. So you have like flour and eggs for the cover, and then you have yogurt, let's say yogurt and salt and pepper and whatnot for your... for your salad, I'm sorry, and for your sauce, and in the end, for your salad. And in the restaurants, you can usually get like a list of allergens, like if you're allergic to something, you want to know if there's, for example, egg in the schnitzel. But you might also want, you will not know this, but the restaurant also needs to care for how long like the eggs are good until they can't serve them anymore, like until they go bad. And also if there is like a what's it called? It's called charge in Germany. I don't know the English term, I'm sorry. Let's say you buy like 10 crates, they have a certain number of them. Number one is from one vendor, number two is from another. And maybe vendor one tells the restaurant that their batch of eggs was bad, so they can throw the whole batch away. Batch is probably the one, I don't know. All right, there's some critical information in there, like allergens, but yeah. You can't totally map it to software, but let's say it's kind of, I think you get the message. All right, so what can we do with the low transparency? Now every team can build an SBOM for their schnitzel or their software projects and throw it at the security team. And if you are a company that sells software to the US government, you actually have to give them you have to provide an SBOM for them. If you are a European company that does software that is not open source, you will at least have to create an SBOM and keep it for, I think it's 10 years, or the EOL of the software plus 5, whichever is longer. And then you have to care for that it's like, in Europe, the current setup of the Cyber Resilience Act only requires you to actually have it and not to show it to your customers. But I have already seen companies that advertise software that will also give you the SBOM for their software. Like if you, let's say you are about to buy a product and you have two alternatives, and you can just like ask the companies if they can supply an SBOM, so you know what they put inside, what allergens are in there. And then like you can put that into consideration. Like you have, let's say one product has a cool feature, but the other company is up to deliver you an SBOM, so you might depend or you might consider which one you like better. All right, quick look at SBOMs. So there's two major formats. I won't go into this. There's probably more, but I know the Cyber Resilience Act references these two, so it should be one of those, at least in the current setup, I think. An SBOM is a JSON file. Anyone can edit this. It's possible to sign it, so depending on which format you take, you have to do certain extra measures, so you can save it and later show that it hasn't been altered. You know, like, if it's just a JSON file and I have to provide one for, let's say, 3 years ago, at a certain point in time, I could just go to the JSON and write shit inside. So I did never use Log4Shell. I was always on Log4J1. So you have to care for authenticity and make it tamper-proof. And I could show a file, but it's just a long JSON file. I think you've all seen those. But the point is, you don't want to look like the security team in my example now has a shitload of JSON files. Do you want to look at JSON files all day? Nobody wants this. So there is tools that can analyze this. Usually it's like all the security vendors that sell shiny UIs and shiny stuff can do this in any way, but there's also dependency track, which is open source and it's basically free. So I can probably show this to you. Again, no advertisement. I like dependency track, but I only use it on a small side project for now. So there it just works. I don't actually know how it behaves. I know that you can like import, and I think I tested up to 80 megabytes of a SBOM, and this is like a couple 10,000s of lines. So it's okay with big files. I don't know how it works if you have like 2,000 projects. So you might need to find that out. So basically, you have some kind of fancy dashboards overall. So let's say my example company, which has like 3 demo projects and this big S project, has like over 12,000 vulnerabilities, which is probably not so good. But then you can, and this is like something you can give each team an API key for dependency track, so they can just upload their SBOMs, and you can also like give each team access so they can check their SBOMs and their status, and then you can have like, for example, a security team that sees all the projects because they just want the transparency about it, and then you can go over like. Certain projects, and I made one which is called Broken. This is the one I showed you earlier. It's the 2025 version. The other one is like 5 years old and has a lot more vulnerabilities over the time. So now you see you have 2 critical vulnerabilities. These are the ones that I also showed you earlier. And you can generate SBOM basically for any framework like Java or anything that, or Python or whatever, also Docker, anything that has like a dependency file. So the code has to know where all this comes from. I don't think it's possible in C, but then again, I'm not a big C coder. So you can probably, I don't want to say ChatGPT again. Someone will know. And then you can do like stuff like add policies to it, and I don't want to go like over all the details of this tool, but you can add policies that do an alert or open a Jira ticket or add to other frameworks, like for example, if you run Defect Dojo to manage vulnerabilities, then Dependency Track can interact with Defect Dojo or interact with Jira and then interact through Jira with Defect Dojo or whatever your setup is. So in the end, you can do alerts. It can also speak to Teams or whatever is Slack and send messages or API messages around. So you can have some kinds of alert. So if someone creates an SBOM and uploads it, Dependency Track can check it and say, hey, look, you added like 2 critical vulnerabilities, or you can add a policy that sends an alert if there is more than 1 medium, but also if there's 1 high and whatever. It's pretty good on sending messages, basically. It's like kernel all the way. All right, so who must supply an SBOM or create an SBOM? I already said that, everyone. If you're in Europe, in the next, I think it starts the end of 2026, maybe 7, I'm not sure right now. When do you create an SBOM? Personally, I would do it with the release, because you already have dependency check as a developer that will also alert your new vulnerabilities when you add new libraries. I think it gets too much stuff in dependency check at track, so where you gather all the SBOMs if you do every snapshot and every preview version, so I would just do it with every release. Anything you would also ship to your customer or run in production should, in my opinion, have an SBOM. And then you can decide if you want to give the customer this SBOM too. So who wants to analyze it? I think the security team, hopefully nobody manually, so just automated alerts, hopefully. And then I've already said a lot of stuff about dependencies. You can also just check. Like, I'm a security person or an administration person. There is maybe not a vulnerability, but maybe a problem in any kind of new container, and I want to know which team is running this. So next time I do a deployment cycle to production, nothing breaks. So this is like the transparent, you can just search it. Yeah, and then, as I said, handing it out to customers is like your deal. All right. And another topic that I really like is automated patching. I said I'm really lazy. I also showed you I have like 10,000 libraries that I use on a daily basis. If you have a lot of projects and a lot of grown projects over time. You gather a lot of possible updates and patches. So your manager might ask you, why are you doing the updates all the time? Well, I don't know. Why are you? So this is like, I want to show a tool in a minute. And this is, if you run GitHub, you've probably seen Dependabot messages. Dependabot does the security scanning, but can also do updates. I have not found a free tool that can do both, but you can combine them. So use dependency check to see if there's security issues, and then you can use renovate later on to make updates. The problem is, why would you update? There's this old saying, like, never change a running system. My guess is, please do. Please keep on track with updates. So just like envision like a probably typical project. You have a project that is okay in a couple of versions, but you keep on version one because it works. You know, you don't need the features that come later. Just assume there's, at some point, there's a major version two that has a breaking change. Let's say some API changes, you can't just throw it in and roll it out. And then you have like a 2.1 that you haven't updated to because you're running version one already. Still. At some point, a vulnerability gets found in a later one, and then you have a fix in an even later one, but you can't update because you missed the breaking change in between. And usually you don't want to fix the breaking changes under pressure. You know, like you want to keep on top of updates, so you are at a relatively new version so that you can react on an update. Also, what might happen is you could have a different library that interacts with the other one. And you might have a breaking change in one, but you might later have interoperability problems within the libraries. You know, and so if you don't keep on track with all of them, you can't like quickly react if a problem arises. So please, consistently run updates. Try to be modern. And also use third-party update software that gets frequently updated. It's cool if you run a very special Java library that has all the features you need, but if it hasn't been touched for 4 years, it like gets old. And the problem might be that if there's a vulnerability, there's no maintainer anymore, and you won't get a patch, and you have to fork it. And that's kind of like, you don't want to do this if the vulnerability is already there. Also, manual updates suck. Still suck, even if you use tools that already has list outdated stuff, and then you can use GitHub, and you can use Dependabot, and I'm running out of time, so I need to like go faster. I told you before, right? Okay, so Renovate. Renovate is a cool tool that can analyze your dependencies and their versions, and find updates. So Renovate will find out, for example, in this example, I'm using a Java Maven setup. I could also have like a GitLab CI or GitHub Actions or whatever, something that runs container images. And then it can check some kind of registry for newest updates. And then it can just automatically create a pull request if the update happens. And I'll show an example in a second. And for it to work, at least for basic use, it's really easily to automate it. You can run it locally, but obviously we're lazy, so we want to automate this. So we want to put this in some kind of CI pipeline. Renovate can do JavaScript. It's JavaScript based. It's written in JavaScript, but it can basically update anything that has some kind of versioning. So you can do stuff like Docker, but as I said, you can also use stuff like Kubernetes, you can use any images, you can use Helm charts, you can use Terraform. Anything of these, and you can find a list on the page, I won't show this for now. There is a, if it has some kind of versioning and you use the version in your code, so please don't use latest. Then it can update it and do pull requests where if, let's say, version 2 is released and it will just make a pull request to your version 1 that says version 2, you can review it or automatically merge it. And please don't look at the links because I forgot to update these. Quick demo. No, this setup is really crap. All right. So I have set up two repositories. One of it is the repository that runs Renovate. And I can just show it to you. It's really small. It's just a JSON file that is configuring the repo itself. I will get to that later. And a config file and a GitLab CI. The GitLab CI just does use the Renovate container, run it. That's it. And then there's a config file, and there's a lot of stuff you can use, but it's not that important for now. What's important, if you try it, please restrict the repositories it should look at for updates. When I got that in a company before, I used a very privileged account in GitLab to do this, and then I opened like 500 onboarding PRs to many people's repositories. It's probably good in the end because then they all have Renovate, but it's probably, you don't make friends a lot if you put so much work without notice. You could add stuff like basic configuration. I won't go over anything like who is the author of the commits that actually do the updates. Stuff like should there be a configuration pushed into a repository? I'll show that in a second with the actual onboarding config. If you want some extra stuff, I'll show some options later on. And then you have like you can automate this. And then I don't know, where is it? Oh yeah, actually, first thing this thing can do is update itself. You know, like because you want your update tools to stay up to date also. The ones further below, you can. They also say abandoned. They are really old. I used this tool for a demo in 2022, recently, like for example, 4 hours ago, I did some updates to prepare this. Like the GitLab CI is running on 41.60, so Renovate has acknowledge that its own project is using an outdated version, so it asks me in a pull request to update to 41.62, and just a quick example. So this is basically the change that you would otherwise have to do manually, which you can't do if you run like 15 projects at once. All right, and then you want to like schedule it so it gets put a cron job around so this job that does the updates runs like every couple hours or every couple days, depending on how often you want to update. All right, then I've put up another repository. You don't need to learn about GitLab scheduling. Also, no advertisement for GitLab. I personally use GitLab because I think it's pretty easy to use, but you can use whatever automation you like. So I have also added the Java project that you saw earlier to as a demo repo and added this to the Renovate configuration so that it also renovates this and also updates my Java project. And what this onboarding merge request or pull request looks like is like this. It scans all the projects, and if it has a Renovate configuration, it just proposes updates, and if it does not, it proposes a Renovate configuration. So this is like basic explanation, and then you have like detected package files. This one was a Maven project, so it only has Maven. But if you have like a highly automated setup, you might also find stuff like GitLab files or Terraform files or whatever the fun you're doing. And and then it will just add like this configuration file, renovate.json, I called it. I think nowadays it should be called different. I stay with renovate.json. It still acknowledges it because I don't want to have four files being called config. And then you get a dependency dashboard where it will actually write down all the update that it's that it will like propose to you. And now, if you merge this onboarding request, you get a lot of new merge requests, which is like, hey, I seen the plugin that I used earlier to create the dependency check report. There's a new version. Please update. And also Maven, and also at the dependency issue page you just saw, there was the Java upgrades for the log4shell problem. So there is no priority, it just it goes top down, and then you can rate limit it. And there's only two, because the default config says there's only two per hour, so or only two in parallel, so there's no more. All right. So I can either... I talk too much, as I said before. So I can either go and show you like two more things, or I can answer questions. Are there any more questions for now? Otherwise, I will just show you some more stuff, and then we can meet at Milliways or outside if they throw us out for questions. Yeah, sure. Okay, so apparently there's a question from the stream, and we're figuring out how it works.
All right.
The Herald mic,
How can you be confident that the S-bomb is accurate? What stops a vendor from lying?
Well, technically, you could open up the software and then look what's inside and maybe find something. If I was a vendor and I would like to lie to you, I would not give you any SBOM. Like, if I have like totally outdated packages, I probably don't want to give you an SBOM. Because if you are caught lying as a vendor, that is probably more painful than not saying anything at all. Also, please don't do that. All right, any more? Otherwise, I'll...
Any more from online? No, that's it. So okay. I think
I go on.
You go on.
Awesome.
Yes.
So there's one more problem. Now you have automated updates. So the soon as an update gets released, you instantly push it into your system. If it's highly automated, it also gets built and put in your release, and then it gets tested. If it works, it gets shipped to production. Okay, modern continuous deployment. So actually, 2 weeks ago, there was like a big issue because somebody phished a couple of credentials from NPM users, and they had like two very widely used NPM packages, and the attackers were able to use these, package malware on top, and release them as a new version. So if you do automated updates, this would be really bad, because then a couple minutes later, you could have like the bad malware in production. So there's two possibilities to work around it. Either break your Renovate setup, because then you cannot have compromised packages. But there is also a couple of configurations. And I think one of the most important ones is the minimum release age, where you can set a timer, like let's say today a malware is packaged on top of some version, then you can say the release is from today, I will only install this on Saturday, like plus 5 days. And also this is not only about vulnerabilities on malware that gets packed onto versions, but also if the release is broken, the vendor might pull it back. So unrelease it, revoke it. So GitHub or NPM allows itself to pull back packages up to 48 hours if they don't work. And the problem is Renovate can only patch forward. So new version that is higher gets an update. If the version gets pulled, you can't like go back. All right. And then you have more options. But Renovate has a really good doku or documentation. Just check it out. I think personally it's really good. It saves you a lot of time, and you can stay on top of things otherwise, which you otherwise couldn't. And then I have a lot of shit to go, but sorry, I missed time. Whatever you do, one more. Whatever you do, please update. Keep your services on top of updates. And thank you.
Thanks a lot for saying.